The following progressive roundtable discussion is titled Corporate Personhood, Taking Stock. The speaker is Jane Ann Morris, a corporate anthropologist. She is the author of the recently published book, Gaveling Down the Rabble, How Free Trade is Stealing Our Democracy. Ms. Morris maintains that corporate personhood permeates our economy, politics, and society, yet many people are at best only vaguely aware of its consequences. She discusses the implications to our democracy of this dubious legal concept. This event was sponsored by the Madison Institute and held on November 21, 2009 at the Capitol Lakes Retirement Community in Madison, Wisconsin. Jane Ann Morris.
Since our theme is corporate personhood, more or less, I thought I would start with a corporation joke. Okay. Corporation walks into a bar, orders a beer. Bartender listens, looks, then says, "We don't serve your kind here." Corporation says, "All right, then just give me a bud." Okay, not quite sure what to make of that. Well, that's kind of the point of my talk. What goes through our mind when someone says corporation walks into a bar? What goes through our mind when someone says, what is a corporation? Now, I think we need to understand historically and practically what a corporation is and has been in this country. And then I think we need to understand what we think it ought to be. And then I think we should work toward it. So that's a capsule of what I want to talk about today. I've decided to give the really big picture, since over the last 15 years I've talked about and been asked about corporate personhood many, many times. And often I'm the nitpicky one saying, wait, you can't quite say that. But today, since I've been asked so many times, I do want to paint the big picture. So I'm taking a little slack in doing that, and we can have a discussion of many details later. I also have a little good news, and I'm saving it for the end. And the other thing I want to say is that all lawyers know this. Perhaps not the whole history of it and all the things, but they basically know how things operate because they use it every day. So I want to start out now by talking about the current situation. Every time a state legislative session opens in any state, corporate lawyers and lobbyists go up to the legislature and they drop off their latest changes and modifications to the corporate code. Okay, I'm sure you see the big announcement every year in the Wisconsin State Journal about this happening, right? We never hear about it. It's not reported, and it's almost never contested. And it is true, the changes in the last couple decades have been minuscule compared to the changes before then, but they're still being made. Okay, one of the problems is that we don't pay attention to this because the corporation law of the state, the corporate code, is essentially a platter of described in infinite detail the privileges and powers and protections that corporations have. And I think it deserves a lot more attention. So the fact that corporations have this huge platter of powers, privileges, rights, protections leaves us in a situation where every once in a while someone perks up about what has become known as corporate personhood. So year after year, decade after decade, there are a number of effects of corporate personhood. And the first thing I want to do is just lay out a number of examples. Because that's one of the things I've noticed. Everyone's against corporate personhood. And then someone says, well, what exactly would change if we didn't have corporate personhood? And often things get a lot murkier after that. Let's think of elections or referendums. Every time we have one, it's corporate dominated, both through corporate donation, campaign donations to candidates, through the fact that they blanket the airwaves and the other media, and so on. If grassroots groups manage to have enough bake sales to raise enough money to actually have a television ad run once on a network, many times, if it's a really hard-hitting ad, the networks, which are also corporations, can refuse to run it. We've had the McCain-Feingold law and other campaign reforms like the Federal Election Act Campaign Act of, I think it was 1974, for a long time, and frankly, I've been voting since then, and I haven't noticed a great improvement in the amount of corporate participation or effect on elections. In fact, I think we can say it's going downhill fairly fast. Now, all of those things are related to corporations' First Amendment rights, which is one of the rights that they have gotten as a result of so-called corporate personhood. Until those are questioned, things are not going to change. Okay, behind all this, we actually have a constitutional right for corporations. Second example, think of times when you have heard when a corporation has gotten a huge fine, like the Exxon Valdez, or huge damage award. What happens in these cases? 5, 10, 15, 20 years of appeals and rehearings of appeals of rehearings of denials of motions and so on and so forth. Okay, for most corporations, okay, this is aside from the fact that if they do pay a fine, it comes from stockholders, from workers, or from consumers, basically. It doesn't come out of the board of directors' salaries and so on. In most cases, the worst case scenario for corporations is that they have to wait a long, long time and maybe pay a small fine. Okay, why is this the case? We have come to understand that this is how things are. The reason that's the case is because corporations have due process rights, which wasn't always the case. It's one of the first things they get from so-called corporate personhood. Due process, infinite appeals, and since they also have near infinite resources to pursue these appeals, it goes on forever. And usually the people who, whether it's a class action or a government, are dead or retired before anything ever gets paid. And plus, all the resources they've spent on that one corporation, they're not spent on enforcing things on 3,000 other corporations which may be doing similar things. Third examples. State and local economies have long made all kinds of efforts to, governments have long made all kinds of efforts to protect their economies from huge corporations, whether it's chain stores, discount stores, big box stores, that sort of thing. And over the history of the United States, especially in the first few decades of the 20th century, there were numerous state and local laws to do exactly that, which were expressly addressed at preventing a big corporation from out of state from wrecking their economy and putting all their local businesses, does this sound familiar? Putting all their local businesses out of business. Most of these were declared unconstitutional long ago on equal protection grounds. What is equal protection? It's part of the 14th Amendment, which was one of the first constitutional rights granted to corporations through corporate personhood. In other words, the fact that you can say a corporation's equal protection rights are being violated is part of corporate personhood. And that has long prevented local and state governments from protecting their economies in that way. There have been similar efforts, especially in Midwestern states, to protect family farms or to protect the farming of a state from being completely taken over by corporate agriculture. This has been done through laws and through constitutional amendments. A relatively recent one was in South Dakota, and the corporations and their lobbyists and lawyers always try to take these to court. And they have for many years taken them to court, the states to court that passed these laws, gotten the laws weakened and changed and altered and so on. And they long tried to use the equal protection constitutional right, but actually one that has worked for them better in the recent past is another clause of the Constitution, the Commerce Clause, which is basically where a court can say a state law or measure is a trade barrier and therefore unconstitutional. And this is near and dear to me because I just wrote a whole book on the history of that clause, and I'm going to mention some of that later. Another example, regulatory agency decisions. This is similar to damages and fines. First of all, the procedures go on forever. And there are the usual rehearings and exemptions and variances and hearings and appeals of the motion to rehear and all this kind of stuff. A very similar situation to what we have in the courts. But with the regulatory agencies, it can be anything from worker safety, environmental regulations, air and water quality, and so on. And we find that after the agency has made a decision, which is the application usually of a state or federal law, that the corporation can, in fact, appeal that, not only through the regulatory agency, but in many, many cases also through the courts. Where did that come from? Wasn't always true. That is a direct result of corporate due process rights, which come from the 14th Amendment, which is usually what corporate personhood is defined as. Another sort of thing that local and state governments have done, you probably remember the 1980s anti-apartheid laws and disinvestment laws. So a university, a state, or a locality might have said, okay, no investment in these corporations which do business in South Africa, or no procuring supplies from them, and so on. You remember that, and I think a lot of people think that those measures played a large part in eventually getting South Africa turned into a very different, though not perfect, place. Well, most lawyers now agree, in articles that I've read on it, that those laws would now be considered unconstitutional. Let's just call them selective procurement or selective investment laws. They'd now be unconstitutional. Okay? Things have changed that much since the 80s. And an example I would cite was the state of Massachusetts, which passed similar laws about buying things from corporations that did business in Burma because of military dictatorship and the human rights violation. There was a case on this. It was called the Massachusetts Burma Law. It went through the courts, and in fact, it was declared unconstitutional on grounds that are a little complicated, and it went through several appeals courts. My point is that even things that we were using in the 1970s and 80s, like selective procurement and investment, have, because of the increasing infringement of corporate personhood kind of rights and protections, become unconstitutional. OSHA and government inspections. Since the early 20th century, approximately 1906, the Supreme Court has recognized Fourth Amendment protections for corporations. This is the protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. And doesn't matter whether it's a corporate facility like a factory, it could be a grain warehouse, and so on. Inspections, if you've ever worked in one of those places when an inspection happens, are already sort of on the meaningless end of things because there's notice given and this sort of thing. But those kinds of inspections are getting further and further encroached upon. A more recent example is a famous 1978 case where OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, was essentially prevented from making a meaningful inspection of a factory. So this is another case of a corporate constitutional right that got there through essentially the gateway of corporate personhood. Okay. I'm just going to give a couple more examples because I'm trying to convince you with how overwhelming and broad the situation is. Labeling requirements, near and dear to our hearts. And if you read the history of them in this country or other countries, they have been going around forever, as have disputes about them. We might be talking about packaged foods because we want to know what the ingredients are. We might be talking about imported things like meat that we want to know the country of origin or even the state of origin on it. Might be a matter of chemicals in toys, might be RBGH or genetically modified organisms, or it might even be that we want to have information about the method of production, using prison labor or child labor and so on. Labeling laws like these, especially if they have teeth in them, no pun intended, are regularly prohibited or declared unconstitutional. And frankly, this has been done under a variety of corporate constitutional protections, which we can talk about later, including one called negative free speech, by the way. But my point here is that as long as we leave those protections in place, this is going to continue, and our ability to even label something is going to get smaller and smaller. We could talk about another thing which states used to do, which is when a corporation from another state was doing business there and they need permission to do it, the state in which they were doing business regularly required them to, as a condition of doing business in their state, agree to have cases against them heard in state courts, saying, we're letting you in our state, we're letting you do business here or sell things or have a factory. If a dispute arises, that case will be heard in state courts. And this was long law. It went up to the Supreme Court 3 times. And on the 3rd time, the Supreme Court said, wait, no, that's a stupid idea. And the reason was because corporations have constitutional rights, and the states can't require their abridgment as a condition of doing business in their state. There are all kinds of other local bans, and you probably can think of some examples of them, where states or localities have, in order to protect themselves, and this goes back to time immemorial, protecting bad stuff from coming in, protecting good stuff from going out, and just generally managing the border. Many, many, many of those kinds of laws, and a lot of them are very green, and greener than you might suspect from quite a long time ago, because people understood protecting their own areas, have been thrown out because of corporate constitutional rights. Okay, so that's the end of my big picture summary of where we are on this. It's a tiny sampling of all the things going on. And I think it leaves us essentially in a kind of democracy theme park, because we can pass little laws, we can do little things, but anything that really has teeth in it is appealed until it gets to a federal court, and then it's declared unconstitutional. And there are literally thousands of examples out there. So one of the things I want to make sure we understand is that corporate personhood and related constitutional protections are not abstractions. They're not vague annoyances. They underlie almost everything about every aspect of our lives. They also underlie the failure of us kind of people since the 70s that I can testify to personally to get nearly as far as we need to in protecting the general welfare. So I believe we need to really understand what corporations can do with a bucket of due process or a spray bottle of equal protection and the wide array of other constitutional protections that they have. And then once we understand it, which isn't easy because it's not something you usually hear on the news, then we need to undo it. And then we can begin to take apart our democracy theme park and actually apply it, because probably as many people think now, we need to do that soon. Okay, now that I've laid that out, I want to sort of pick it apart and be a little more precise. Just doing a preliminary quick history, corporations are created, almost all of them, in the United States through the action of state legislatures, which essentially give them a charter. Our charters have varied a great deal over time. But and now it's essentially just the corporate code, the law under which they were incorporated. Charters used to be individual per corporation. And until the late 19th century, despite much corruption and despite the fact that most people from Europe in this country weren't exactly environmentalist, despite that, states strongly controlled the corporations they created, to the point where they created it. If it did something the state legislature didn't like, they just revoked its charter. And for a long time, this didn't even require the participation of any kind of courts. Okay, so states said, you do A, B, and C. You can have your office on the northwest corner, not the southwest corner. If someone came back and they put their office on the wrong corner, they just revoked the charter, figuring that if theoretically the people elect their legislators, the legislators created a corporation, gave it a purpose, told it what to do. If it didn't do the purpose, why keep it around? So we have come so far from that kind of attitude that it sounds bizarre, like some sort of science fiction thing now. But that's where we used to be. In the late 19th century, a number of things happened at once. Corporate lawyers emerged. There weren't any corporate lawyers before. People didn't study corporate law. Lawyers were like boring people who sat around, no offense to anyone, writing wills and doing like nitsy things like that. And in the late 19th century, all of a sudden there were corporate lawyers, and they started the revolving door really quickly between government, corporations, and various agencies. Second thing that happened is that corporate lawyers began convincing the courts, not the legislatures, the courts, that corporations were in fact kinds of things that could have constitutional rights of persons, of citizens, and other protections. And coincidentally, and I'm sure you all know this, that period coincided exactly with the rise of the large, incredibly powerful corporation from approximately 1870 or so to the 1930s. Another thing you may not be quite as aware of is that that is also the time when regulatory agencies arose. So if you actually plotted the power, as you ticked up the increasing power of corporations, you would also be ticking up the increasing presence and power of regulatory agencies, and you'd be ticking down the power of legislatures to control corporations. So with that extremely brief history of a really critical part of our history, I want to talk about these protections for corporations and sort them out for you. There are two kinds. Just like there are two kinds of people, the kind who divide things into two groups and the kinds who don't. But I'm going to take all these protections and kind of put them in two easy to understand groups. The first kind are the kind that are linked to rights of corporations. And this group assumes that corporations are the kinds of entities that can have rights. So you could say, this corporation has the right to what? Or this corporation has this right. As you've probably heard, among the first to be granted officially by the U.S. Supreme Court were 14th Amendment rights of equal protection and due process. And it was linked to the word in the 14th Amendment, persons. It came to be said that corporations, for the purpose of the 14th Amendment, are persons with equal protection and due process rights. Now, this was pretty much decided by a few cases, not one, in the 1880s. There's one in 1886, the Santa Clara case, which everyone cites. There were two more in 1888 and 1889, which were much clearer. It was discussed within the context of the case. But among the three of them, it was clearly affirmed that starting now, the Supreme Court was going to acknowledge that corporations had equal protection rights and due process rights. Okay? That soon became a gateway to other rights. You realize what it means when you say a corporation has equal protection rights. That sounds sort of abstract. What it means is lawyers, on behalf of that corporation, can go into court and say, my corporation is being discriminated against. And in fact, that is the word that uses. So the corporation then has a very wide range of arguments to say, you're treating my corporation different from that corporation, or different from that type of corporation, or different from corporations in Iowa, and so on. So it just opens up an infinite array of creativity for saying, this is discrimination. So that's how it used. This was then a gateway to other rights that I've mentioned. Early 20th century, in 1906, a case which recognized Fourth Amendment corporate rights against unreasonable searches and seizures, and growing through other rights in the 20th century, and especially since the 1970s, corporate First Amendment rights have vastly increased. From simple commercial free speech, we have to tell you how much the car costs, to, you know, kind of a broader sense of commercial free speech, to even areas that are more like political speech and other free speech. And this has really sort of gotten out of control, I think, in a lot of the campaign finance reform discussions. And then finally, also, as you probably remember from the 80s, corporate rights have expanded to include takings rights under the Fifth Amendment. Okay, related to not having your property taken without just compensation. So those are all things you can say, the corporation has this right. Okay, that's sort of the easier to understand group. There's another group, which I'm just calling other constitutional protections for corporations. And I'm not going to go into as much detail on this, but I want to give you the idea of what it's like. It's a little bit more subtle. It's a matter of using other clauses in the Constitution in ways that essentially allow corporations and their lawyers to go into court and get state and local, especially, laws thrown out. Also works with federal laws, but has been used less against them. And the example I'm going to give of this is one that I just wrote a whole book on, so of course it's clear to mind. Other examples, you may have heard of the Contracts Clause. Protecting the obligation, states may not impair the obligation of contracts. I'm not going to go into it, but that's been used a lot. Also, various generalizations in the Constitution about citizenship have been used a little. But the example I'm going to give of this other kind of constitutional protection is the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Basically, the Commerce Clause is found in the first article under the powers that Congress have. There's an enumeration of what Congress can do. And one of the things is regulate trade among the several states. To make a long story short, and we can talk about this later in another way if you want, that was really not used at all in federal cases until 1870. After that, it started being used as a way for federal courts working closely with corporations to declare many, many, many state and local laws unconstitutional by saying they're trade barriers. What? You can't do that. That's a trade barrier. Okay, now you will recognize this language because this is identical to the language that comes up in NAFTA and WTO, GATT, and other so-called free trade things. So I frankly picked this out because a lot of people didn't understand it, and it's been here a long time, and our imposition of a free trade zone within the United States was actually the dry run for what started in 1944 at Bretton Woods. So this kind of constitutional protection does not involve saying a corporation has a right to this. You don't have to say that at all. It's just a piece of the Constitution which is used in federal courts by corporations to leverage their way out of having state and local laws apply to them. Okay. These things were first sort of worked out and argued out and established through court cases. However, they didn't stay just there. And this is one kind of misunderstanding that sometimes arises. Eventually, as those state legislatures went to work rewriting their corporate code every time they met, with a corporate lawyer standing nearby going, yes, no, here's a little better language for that. As this happened, many of these constitutional protections essentially got written into the law so that today they are not found only in court cases, though you can see their history and understand how they developed that way. They are essentially written into law, including various things that we might call corporate personhood. So what I've tried to lay out there is just take a step back and say, corporate personhood has been taken to mean the rights under the 14th Amendment, and some people use it in a broader sense to include the rights, especially under the 4th, 1st, and 5th Amendments, too, actually having rights. If you want, and some people use it loosely, also to include an array of other constitutional protections. But I'm just telling you, technically, you can put them in two groups. One that literally involves saying a corporation has this right, and another group that very much have been used to protect corporations but don't involve that ability. So I'd like to just take a tiny break here, just to sort of use some of my writings to set up the history of how I ended up doing this, since I really am an anthropologist. And I ended up working with the group doing a lot of this starting in the mid-90s. My first book was this, Not in My Backyard, the Handbook, which isn't exactly about the fight in Texas, but it's what I learned from there that I didn't want anyone else trying to protect their neighborhood, trying to see to the general general welfare of their community, their town, their state, would need to know. And we made almost every mistake you could make. Therefore, we didn't get as far and we were slower. And I thought, if I could just write up everything we learned, if we knew at the beginning of this what we now know, people could get further. So I wrote this up, and this came out in 1994. And shortly after that, I ran into a bunch of people, and by then I had been doing activist things for quite a while, because that was after my various kinds of activism and my dissertation and my teaching anthropology. So by the time this finally got out there, because I was writing it in my spare time, I had also participated in a lot of activism. And things that were first shocking to me, I began to realize were sort of more common. And then I began to realize this is what always happens, which was a shock in itself. I fell in with a number of people who also had been activists since the 60s and 70s and were thinking the same thing, like, we are working very hard. We are following the rules. We are reading these incredibly boring air quality regulations or other kinds of things, and we're following the instructions and doing everything they say, why aren't we getting any further than we are now? I mean, we're running as fast as we can and slipping backwards. And a group of those people came together, and they still are together with almost none of the original members, but the group was called the Program on Corporation Law and Democracy. I lasted about 10 years, from 95 to 2005. But we shared the fact that we were sort of frustrated, and we needed to understand why this wasn't working. So to make a long story short, we started reading corporate law. Oh, big shock. I mean, I can do Australian kinship charts if there's any anthropologists in here, and corporate law was just something. And during that, I kept running into this stuff, this phrase called constitutional law. And, of course, I ignored it. I was up to here with corporate law, constitutional law, whatever that was, I wasn't going to go there. You know, yes, I believe in civil rights and all that, but I didn't want to deal with it. And it kept coming up again and again. It seems to me I couldn't read anything about corporate law without seeing this phrase, constitutional law. So I made up a story to myself. And the story was something like this. It sounds idiotic, but, you know, we all go through a learning phase here. I thought, well, if a law is constitutional, then it's constitutional and it's law. But if it's not constitutional, it's not a law. And the message was, I don't have to worry about it. So I put off for another little while. Finally, I realized that the history of corporate law and the history of constitutional law is really intertwined. And you can't get anywhere in corporate law without understanding constitutional law. And why is that? Because since at least the 1880s, corporations have had constitutional rights. And when we think equal protection is about, you know, minorities in schools or something, corporations see it completely differently. So I got in with this group. We did a lot of work trying to understand in all our areas why we weren't getting further. And what we discovered was corporations and constitutional law was really inextricably linked. One of the people in it was a labor activist, and he wrote this excellent book called Building Unions, which is how to apply all this to unions, because basically unions got put into regulatory agencies in 1935, and many of the huge gains of labor movement in this country came before then. I just want to show you the spread. We put out a lot of literature and a newsletter some of you may be familiar with called By What Authority? And at one point, we actually got our act together to put a lot of those things together in a book, which is called Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy. It came out in about 2001 or something. And just as an example, so you can get a sense of what it's about, I'm going to mention a few things in here so you can see the breadth of this. And hopefully, this will link to what I just was talking about. I got to write the first essay, which is called Help, I've Been Colonized and I Can't Get Up, which is just about how, without seeing this corporate constitutional right thing, we were kind of like fighting an ever-losing battle and we couldn't quite figure out why. And also, well, get to that later. I have a little thing in here on why we research corporate law, because that wasn't immediately apparent to us. I mean, the environmentalists among us, we're doing environmental law. The labor activists among us, we're doing labor law, and so on. No one was doing corporate law or constitutional law, per se. I have an essay in here about corporate social responsibility and how that links with corporations' rights and their ability to co-opt many activist settings. I have an article in here called Corporations for the Seventh Generation, which was also called Fixing Corporations in other reprints. And essentially that talks about some of the ways that all states have of essentially defining and ordering corporations around in quite a few of the decades of the 19th century. And I have an article in here called Speaking Truth to Power about Campaign Reform. It talks about what campaign reform, and I particularly don't use the phrase campaign finance reform, what campaign reform would look like if we took away corporate First Amendment and other rights. And we wanted to design a campaign where anybody could run, not just millionaires. When's the last time you heard of a non-millionaire running for public office at the state level or above? Okay. And finally, I have an essay in here called Sheep in Wolf's Clothing. And this is about regulatory agencies. And in fact, it's about 5 pages long, and I've told a lot of people this. I say, if you read this essay about the history of how regulatory agencies got started and how they work, and at the end of that time you still think that there's something positive about them, I'll buy you a beverage of your choice. And no one has ever taken me up on that. Okay, after that, actually, I have a thing in there called the corporate cloaking device or something like that, and that's about corporate personhood in the early days of it, in the late 90s. Now, since then, a lot of people have done and talked about corporate personhood and have, I'll pass these around, you can look at them, talked about corporate personhood, had traveling shows about it, and so on. So I totally backed off that because I understood it and other people were taking it on. What I didn't back off was taking one of the corporate protections that was not specifically linked to a right, the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which is used to throw out state and local laws as trade barriers. And I kept getting asked to explain this because I was looking at it because other people weren't. And someone asked me to write a one-page memo, and that was a 13-page memo. And then I said, they asked me to do a pamphlet, and it turned out into this book, Gaddling Down the Rabble, How Free Trade is Stealing Our Democracy, and this came out last year. And I want to call one more thing to your attention. This is a book called Globalized Liberation, which came out a couple years ago, and I'll pass these around so you can look at them. It's full of essays from a wide range of people, defining the problem, talking about how to change, talking about how to apply them. Anyway, I was asked to write something for the first section in defining the problem. And my essay here is called Try This at Home, which is just a first effort to step back and say, this is how I see the problem, and these are some of the things we can try. So I'll let you look at those if you didn't get the titles and so on. So that it was my way kind of telling you how I came through this and working with other people on this and why it is that I was, you know, been stuck in a law library since the mid-90s, basically. Now, at this time, if I have succeeded in convincing people that, you know, Houston, we have a problem, that this is fairly serious, I often get asked, well, what can we do? And it's so funny for me because if we had segregated schools in Madison, no one would ever ask me, well, what should we do? And no one said, what should we do when the problem came to civil unions and gay marriage recently? I mean, people got right on it. They got activated and they started working on things. But I do understand that there's something about this, corporate personhood or corporate constitutional protections, that is a little harder to get a handle on. And I've been struggling to try and help people get a handle on it for a dozen years, so I understand that it is. So I'm going to give you a few ideas of some things that have been done. One of the things that happened in 2000 from one of the two women who later went around the country on this is a resolution against corporate personhood from Point Arena, California. And it's not even a binding resolution. But in the future, if we ever get anywhere on this, it's going to be referred back to as in the modern era, the first time when someone passed a resolution that said this political entity does not recognize that corporations have political rights, have constitutional rights here.
Where was that again?
Point Arena, California. And in that orangey book, there's an essay about that. The person who I think had most to do with getting it out was Jan Edwards. A couple years later, or around the same time, Arcata, California, raising all these issues, managed to pass a measure which required that the city actually go through all these long meetings talking about what's the role of corporations in our town and is that a good idea. And that was agonizing. It took forever to pass it and then do it. And out of that came a measure some of you may have heard of called Measure T. You know how they are in California with their letters and stuff. But this measure, and I'm not sure of the exact wording of the final version, but basically they had just had a couple elections where really local elections which affected industries and factories and I think the timber industry. When good people who should have got elected were not elected or were forced out because of huge amounts of corporate cash coming from the outside. It was just a very clear example. It had just wrecked their local election. And so they managed to pass a law which isn't as strict as you might like, But it was a start saying, you know what, in our local elections, we are going to try to prohibit corporate cash from outside the county. Something very simple like that. They actually got it passed. They were immediately sued, of course, by corporations. And the last I heard is they ended up backing down. But that's a really courageous thing. And it's the kind of application that you can make which does address corporate personhood matters. And it also gives another signal. If you do something that matters, you get immediately sued, not only by private corporations, by their trade industry groups, by their buddies, by all kinds of people you never heard of before. Third example comes from Pennsylvania and a group which is abbreviated as CELDF, and the Orange Book also has some articles about this, and I refer to this in Try This at Home. It stands for, it's been a long time, Citizens Environmental Legal Defense Fund, I believe. And I think... Pardon me?
Communities.
Right, okay, thank you. Community Environmental Legal... Anyway, it's a group that was started in Pennsylvania by Tom Lindsay, L-I-N-Z-E-Y. And this is a whole long story in itself and an incredibly informative one. And I don't know the results from the last couple weeks. Basically, what happens was that a number of communities in Pennsylvania actually said, you know, after dancing around regulatory agencies for decades and having it not help them with hog farms, quarries, having their environment destroyed, their neighborhoods destroyed, their aquifers damaged, et cetera, they finally said, you know what? This environmental stuff is not working. We've been there. We've jumped through every hoop and danced around it, flaming hoops and bouncing hoops. We're going to go back to pretending that we have a democracy here. And so local governments began passing laws saying, no hog farms here. Or very straightforward things like that. And of course, the onslaught of corporate lawsuits and stuff and procedures they got thrown against them was large, but it was extremely informative. And every time the corporations came back with the lawsuits, what would they say? They would say this to the local government. You can't do that. Who do you think you are? And then the corporations would haul out the list of constitutional rights that the government was violating by passing a law like this. So that was one of the best organizing tools you can have, which is one of the biggest lessons from CELDF. Anyway, those are the kind of things that can be done. And generally, when you have a situation like this, the general areas of activism, and I'm not talking tactics so much as larger action, you could pass a constitutional amendment. Okay? You can always do this. If those of you who remember the ERA remember how easy that is to do. You know, even on something commonsensical, I mean, the amount of hysteria over boys and girls using the same bathroom was just unbelievable. So that's a possibility. And there are a number of people who are suggesting that. But I'll bet you don't know this one. In 1936, the dean of the John Marshall Law School in Chicago sketched out what a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution looked like. 1936, okay, saying we should essentially revoke corporate personhood. And I'll pass this around so you can look at it. So people have been upset about this for a long time. And one of the disturbing things is, and now, is that we're not so upset anymore. So what can you do? One of the things is pass a constitutional amendment. It's possible. It's not easy. And frankly, that doesn't free us from the eternal legalisms. Second thing you can do, which we are very familiar with from the civil rights events, is you can set up a test case. You know, this isn't too hard to do, actually. But I think our obsession with test cases sometimes has the effect of obscuring a huge amount of on-the-ground activism like fire hoses and dogs and so on that had to happen before the test cases would get anywhere. And the third thing you can do, which I actually prefer, is what they started doing in Point Arena and in Arcata and in Tom Lindsay and CELDF in many places, is you can actually do something real that isn't coming out of a democracy theme park where you can do all you want and complain all you want, but nothing's connected to anything. Pass a real law that really has an effect. No hog farms in this township. Attracts people's attention. And from then on, your learning is linked to that, and you learn your constitutional law in a practicum. I mean, you are living it. You are not just sort of reading about, oh, how terrible this sort of problem was. Okay, so I said I have some good news. I'm getting to the end of my talk. I'm going to give you the good news. It seems overwhelming, and I've only given you the tip of the iceberg. But frankly, there's a way to look at it which makes it look really encouraging, which is that when you start looking, and I have read way too many of the cases on this going back to the 1870s and some before. When you look at the arguments that corporations make on any of these issues, whether it's personhood things from the 14th Amendment or other rights, or talk about use of other constitutional protections, frankly, they've only got about a dozen things. There aren't that many of them. And for the most part, there's five or six of them they use over and over again. If you look at the arguments they made about Arcata, the arguments that Tom Lindsay and Seldiff is getting, because they're the same old things. And they have to say in public, we have equal protection rights, which just ticks people off. And it, like I said before, it's a great organizing tool. So actually, Tom Lindsay and others with the group POCLAD that I was working with, as early as the late 90s, came up with different versions of a model brief, which is like the model which you use to oppose the situation when you or your governing entity gets sued by a corporation. And you can kind of like erase proper nouns and put in names of new districts or new corporations, because the arguments aren't that different. And there's another benefit of that, given that they use the same old half dozen arguments, which is exactly what you don't hear in the Wisconsin State Journal, or very much in the New York Times, and when they put it in, they usually get it a little wrong. But that's okay. Not only is there one brief they're using, so you have one brief to answer it, but it clears up a problem that many activists have, where what's happening is, I'm working on downtown community gardens. Well, that means I have less time to work on cleaning up the lakes, and I have less time to work on, you know, keeping pesticides out of schoolyards, and I have less time to work on stopping the war in fill-in-the-blank. So all of us activists, inevitably, even if we agree on all these issues, are structural rivals, as I've only got so much time, and I'm put in here. Good luck over there on the square doing your own thing. Well, since this is an underlying issue, and constitutional protections for corporations are an underlying issue, what happens is, if we all mind our own business and our own personal issues, but take it to the point where we are up against the constitutional protections for corporations, we are all working together on the same thing. We don't even have to have meetings. It's good if we do, and talk to each other and compare notes. But we're no longer feeling that our efforts are taking away from the other, because you get at the same core of basically half a dozen constitutional protections each time you take a campaign far enough. So let's go back to that corporate joke. We need to understand what is going on in our head when we talk about what is a corporation. When we talk about a corporation as though it has an opinion on global warming, oh really? What exactly has the opinion? And once we get clear in our heads what it has been historically, we need to think about what it should be, and then have some difficult discussions about it, because we have been, as I claimed in that article, colonized on this for a long time, because we're fighting over other issues, and often that prevents us from seeing the constitutional protections under all of it. So I want to end, really, this time with one of my favorite examples. In the late 90s, a lot of cell tower companies were trying to site their towers all over, and there were controversies all over for a variety of reasons, and at some level it doesn't matter. Some were health concerns, some were concerns that it was just ugly or it's the wrong place or we just don't like it here, and many local governments actually tried to oppose the siting of cell towers, using their local governments to do what they thought they were doing, you know, seeing to the general welfare. And one company named OmniPoint got denied in a couple cases, OmniPoint Corporation, excuse me, from putting its cell tower where it wanted, you know, on a historic church or whatever it was. And the city, actually it wasn't even a city, I think they were both towns, passed laws saying, no, you can't put it there. Either it's a violation of zoning or this other reason or it's against this ordinance and so on. And they were sued by OmniPoint Corporation and a bunch of others. And the corporation claimed that it was being discriminated against, it was being treated differently from other corporations, its equal protection rights were being violated, and, this is the kicker, therefore it was due damages under the 1964 Civil Rights Amendment. which is based on the 1871 Reconstruction Amendment, Section 1983, if you know it. So, just as a little summary here, that's where we are now, and I think we need to talk about where we want to go. Thank you.
You've just heard a discussion on corporate personhood by corporate anthropologist Jane Ann Morris, author of the book Gabbling Down the Rabble, How Free Trade is Stealing Our Democracy. And now we hear a discussion with the audience.
Well, I recall that in the 60s, we, the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, was very busy trying to get rid of the 1886 law that supposedly, we were told at the time, was making a personhood out of corporations. The Supreme Court actually had not made a decision on that particular question, had left it open, and a clerk of the court interpreted to the assembling jurists who hadn't understood it either, said, well, they made a corporation a person, and that since then this has been enlarged, as you've heard it, beyond all of proportion. And a parallel law that was under attack at that time was called Money Was Free Speech. We were interested, as we are again, to get clean elections out. That those two laws, you're never going to get clean elections.
First of all, I did run across, I think it was an op-ed from Ralph Nader, and I think it was in the late 60s or early 70s, about corporate personhood. And that's the first that, I didn't run into it till the last 15 years or so. That's the first I realized that, oh, you know, every once in a while this comes up, and it hasn't gotten a lot of traction, but it's not because people didn't try. But I do want to do a little clarifying there. What happened in 1886 is the Santa Clara decision of the Supreme Court, which you've probably heard of. It was much of corporate law and constitutional law comes out of railroads, because railroads were one of the big types of corporations during the giant rise of corporations. There was like AT&T in communications, there were some sewing machine, household goods companies, and then there were the meat packers, who are still around today, who started out by serving rotting beef to Civil War soldiers and stuff. You know, that tradition just hasn't gone away. But my point is that so a lot of the law that we need to deal with, the precedents are with railroad corporations. And an awful lot of them are really boring, tedious things about taxes. Because frankly, railroad corporations were consolidating at a huge rate. They were making money hand over foot. They were bankrupting communities as they felt that they wanted to, because they could make more money here. They were manipulating rates. They were buying off legislators. And local communities and states spent a lot of their time just figuring out, okay, this is a giant money-making machine. We are going broke on it, and we're getting terrible service. How can we get something back? So there's a lot of really boring tax stuff. The Santa Clara case was one of those. Should we tax the wheels when they're spinning, or should we tax the fence posts? This is literally, and the railroad corporation had arguments, nope, can't do that. So the Santa Clara case is one where, in a brief set of remarks before the case came out, they say, by the way, we're going to accept that corporations are persons for the purpose of the 14th Amendment, and we don't want to discuss it, which is not very satisfying. And a big deal has been made of it, and there's tons of law review articles discussing whether they planned that when they passed the 14th Amendment, or whether it just popped into someone's mind, and so on. But frankly, I have seen those arguments. I don't spend much time on it, because it doesn't matter at all. Even if that case means nothing, and it is a case, not a law. There were two cases in, I think it is 1888 and 1889 or 1890. One is the Pembina mining case, I believe, and I think one is the Minneapolis and St. Louis or something like that railroad case. And they're in at least two of those books referred to. those two cases clarified and consolidated the decision. So it doesn't really matter whether the 1886 Santa Clara decision was totally goofed up or not. So it's definitely there in the precedents. And after those further two cases in the late 1880s, it's been affirmed and assumed and cited in almost every case since then. So we have a big job on our hands, but it doesn't involve just that one case. It involves all the precedents set in those few years, then how they've been applied, and frankly, they're now written into law. So that's the first question. The second one, the money equals speech thing. After the Nixon election in 1972, there were a lot of calls for reform in the system of presidential elections. And out of that came a campaign law, which is essentially the law, I think it's Federal Election Commission Act of 1974, I think. Out of that law essentially legalized PACs, political action committees. It legalized them. And then there was a court case in 1976, Buckley v. Valeo, I believe, which is the one that essentially set in place the money equals speech thing. Now, I've read that case. It's almost 300 pages long. And I don't know, there are like 50 or 80 different points. And each of the justices had a different opinion on at least five of the points, and they all wrote it down. So it's incredibly complicated. But it's not just about money equals speech. It's also about political parties. And I think you find in that case the key to why is it so difficult to have an independent or a third party? Well, a lot of it was because, frankly, the Republicans and the Democrats did agree on some things, and that is, for many, not all of them, that third parties are a real pain in the neck. So that's a really complicated case, but I still find that most of the discussion that arises from it is on sort of narrow grounds. You know, money equals speech. Well, how much money is too much money and too much speech? And can someone's spouse give $2,000 or $1,999 and it doesn't have to be before April or before this? And distracts us from large questions like, how can we run elections so that any adult has an equal opportunity to be heard and be part of the debate? Isn't that what we want? Not just people who are either very well connected or very well off, which frankly is what we have now, except in very local elections. Anyone who's like in a working class person has hardly a chance. Okay, so that's what the essay in that, give me the book so I can flail them around again. the essay in here, and it's available elsewhere, called us Speaking Truth to Power About Campaign Reform, tries to just broaden the question. We need to talk about, let's pretend we don't live in the world we live in right now. If we wanted to stage an election in Madison or Dane County or Wisconsin and have it be good and fair, and have everyone have an opportunity to be heard, how would we go about doing it? And that's a question that goes far beyond public financing, which just to light another fire here. I personally, and I think most of the people in the program on corporation law and democracy, are opposed to public financing of elections. Gasp. Then I'll tell you why. And the reason is because they don't address very many of the problems with elections. But even more importantly, once you get beyond the local level, do you know where about 80% of the money in elections is spent, where it goes?
Broadcast.
It goes to TV, which, as you know, we're not having a real debate on. And the corporations that run those things jack up the prices at election time. So essentially, it's like a giant vacuum cleaner from all the taxpayers paying 80% of that money to the same corporations who are playing a huge role in us not being able to have better discussions. So on the money and equal speech thing, in the interest of having everyone get to express themselves, I'm just going to say that I think it needs to be much broader than it's been painted in the last couple decades of court decisions on it.
You've just heard a discussion on corporate personhood by corporate anthropologist Jane Ann Morris and author of the book Gaveling Down the Rabble, How Free Trade is Stealing Our Democracy. Audio recordings of this and many other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.